My name is Jason DeRose, and this session is Unearned Intimacies on the Ethics of Telling Other People's Stories. It is perfectly fine if you're here for the first time. Some people are here for the third time. This is, I wouldn't say cumulative, but if you are here for all three sessions, you get more out of it than if you're here for just one of the sessions. So they're designed to stand alone, but also have an effect if you come to all three. So, for those of you who have been here earlier in the week, I want to review a couple of definitions, and I'll do so by asking you some questions. So the title of this series is Unearned Intimacies. And I talked earlier this week about what I think of when I say earned intimacies. So does anybody remember what some of those were? This is both by way of review for people who've been here, but also new information that will be shared with the people who are new here.
Yes? Long-term friendships.
Right, so you know, you've been friends since college, and you're at your 20th reunion, and you've stayed in touch over the years. You've earned a lot of intimacy in that relationship. Other unearned intimacy?
Family.
People you've known since birth. Others?
Marriage.
Through marriage, yes.
Work.
Work, yes. People you've known, colleagues for a decade, things like that. So then, what did I mean when I said unearned intimacies in the context of this class? There are probably others that I'm not here to talk about.
You said that when an interviewer is interviewing an interviewee, that it seems like you're very intimate because all of a sudden the interviewer knows a lot about the interviewee, but it's not really reciprocal.
Right, right. So what I oddly called the journalistic encounter. You enter somebody's life at a particularly difficult, emotional, joyful moment in their lives. You know, the building has just collapsed. They're trying to report sex abuse. You enter into their lives, and you're trying to listen to their stories. So then, yesterday, we talked a little bit about whose story is it. We got into this idea a little bit as well on the first day. In a piece of journalism, I want us to think about whose story is it. So does anybody remember from yesterday who some of the somebodies were in the stories? You don't have to remember their names. You can just look who they were.
You said the editor?
Okay, so the editor. That was what I was going to get through third. How about people in the stories? The real person whose story we're telling. So it's
the tribe.
That woman who has survived, who is reporting a sexual assault, or whose mother is reporting a sexual assault. Other people?
Also the government agencies.
Right, the government agencies were a character in the stories. And I tried to leave it very ambiguous at the end of the day yesterday. I tried to trouble what I was talking about by saying, well, there is the story that we're hearing, and there are individual stories. And what you hear on the radio, or what you listen to in a podcast, is a story that may contain multiple voices, sometimes which are in deep conflict with each other. Sometimes those voices are an expert just explaining something. Sometimes it's a voice of authority. Sometimes it's the voice of the real person without much authority in the story. So today, I want to talk a little bit about some pieces that I've worked on over the last year or so. And we're going to end with a piece that's a couple years old. But I was inspired by Diane's session this morning about multiple voices and storytelling, all of the voices being contained within the tradition. So last year, as I mentioned yesterday, NPR did a big series on discrimination. Oh, I forgot, those of you who haven't been here before, I should say, who I am. I'm Jason DeRose. I'm the Western Bureau Chief for NPR News and the National Editor, Senior Editor for Religion, LGBT Issues, and Native American Issues. So that's the context in which I'm talking. So we did a big study or survey with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation last year and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health that looked at discrimination in America. And I was in charge of overseeing our pieces that came out of that survey that related to LGBT Americans and Native Americans. So the first two pieces today are going to be from the LGBT Americans section. So for those of you who haven't been here, what I'm going to do is play a piece. It's about 4 minutes long, and I'd like you to think about who are the people in this story, who are the voices you're hearing. If you want to take notes, that's totally fine, but let's acknowledge that this is a very artificial way to listen to these stories. Most people who are listening to NPR are doing multiple things in multiple places. So they're waking up and they're in their bed, and then they're in the bathroom, and then they're in the kitchen, and then they're herding their kids, and then they're in the car, and then they're on the way to work. Sometimes they're with one other person, sometimes they're with a few other people, but they're never sitting in a room with about 40 people quietly staring into the middle distance. So you have this opportunity to listen in a way that you probably don't outside of here. This is also an opportunity for me. I have this opportunity to see the audience. When I edit pieces, I'm thinking, this has to work for 30 million people across the country living in big cities and rural places, but I never, until I come here, and one of the reasons I like to come here is I like to see the audience, and you'll notice that when I'm sitting off to the side, I'm watching you, because I just like to see where you look interested or bored or puzzled, or when you take a note, or if you've fallen asleep, or whatever. So I will play this piece. Take notes, don't take notes. It's totally up to you.
Nearly a third of transgender Americans lack regular access to health care. That finding comes in a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson. Nearly a third of transgender Americans lack regular access to health care. That finding comes in a new poll by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. NPR's Netta Ulubi has more.
There's a homeless shelter in Washington, D.C. for LGBT youth like this young woman standing outside.
I'm Ruby Barbie Doll.
Ruby Barbie Doll was kicked out of her home for being transgender. She does not have regular access to health care. Many of the clients here are among that 31%, says the transgender woman who founded Casa Ruby.
31% is a lot.
Ruby Corrado keys in on one crucial word, regular access to health care.
And what does regular health mean? Preventable.
Preventable problems including HIV and cancer. In the NPR poll, 22% of transgender people said they'd avoided doctors or healthcare for fear they'd be discriminated against. Medical professionals have asked Corrado insensitive questions like,
what are you? Your trans status is on parade for people to make fun of you.
Right now, it's very hard for a lot of people even to find a primary care provider who's willing to work with them.
Kevin Baker is an academic at Johns Hopkins University. He studies how health policies affect gay, lesbian, queer, and transgender Americans. He says a number of insurance companies will not cover care related to gender transition, such as hormones or surgery.
You're not able to get health insurance coverage. You can't get health care that you need to make sure that how you look aligns with who you are.
Transition can take many forms, Baker says. Surgery on reproductive organs is expensive, so many people leave them alone. Imagine getting an annual physical as a trans man with a uterus or a trans woman with a prostate, and being told,
what do you mean you need a cervical pap test for a man or a prostate exam for a woman? How do we compute that? You shouldn't have that part, so we don't know what to do with you.
Baker says trans people have died because they've slipped through those cracks. Their bodies treated like they don't make any sense. But there is someplace you can go if you're a transgender person looking for high-quality, low-cost healthcare.
We're in Richmond, Virginia, the Virginia League for Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood trains its staff nationwide to be sensitive to transgender people. Its doctors can give trans women prostate exams, trans men pap smears. This Planned Parenthood in Richmond provides hundreds of patients with hormone therapy. Acton Bradley works on ensuring trans patients are treated well from the minute they walk in the clinic's door.
Does our front desk know how to be affirming? Is our electronic health record affirming? Does it ask about pronouns and gender identity?
Bradley says this Planned Parenthood can handle trans-specific problems, like what happens when a trans woman injects herself with building-grade silicone to get feminine curves, or a trans man buys black market testosterone, or injures himself by binding his chest with duct tape. Brian Brazell is a trans man who gets his care at Planned Parenthood. He remembers his first visit here.
I went out to my car and was like, I felt really weird, and it took me a couple days to figure out why. And it was because it was the first time that I had had a healthcare experience that I was happy with. I didn't really know what that felt like until I had that experience at Planned Parenthood.
An experience wholly unfamiliar to many clients of Ruby Corrado, who runs the homeless shelter in D.C.
I've seen a lot of people die. I've been to a lot of hospitals to recognize bodies that were dead from HIV and violence.
Corrado points to the dozens of trans people violently killed just this year across the country. Another public health issue, almost 20% of Black transgender women are HIV positive. Compare that, says Corrado, to the general population, which is only 3%.
It is very likely, particularly if you are a transgender woman of color, that you will die from HIV, that you will die from AIDS, that you will die stabbed or killed, that you will die from some kind of cancer or suicide.
All potentially preventable. A recent survey of trans people says 40% have attempted suicide in their lifetimes, says Afton Bradley at the Richmond, Virginia Planned Parenthood.
What we see is this dramatic reduction in those attempts when people have access to affirmative care.
Affirmative care meaning treating trans people like people. Bradley says it's not that hard. Nada Ulibi, NPR News.
So often in stories, you go in looking for the right real character, and sometimes the people aren't willing to talk to you. And this is one of those cases where I think the story conveys a fair amount of information, but I'm a little worried about it. I mean, there, so I'm not that worried about it. But I'm a little worried because we meet Ruby Corrado, and we meet a little bit of Ruby Gardadal at the top. But it's hard to hang your hat on a real person in this story. How did that make you feel when you heard the story? That like it's not one person's sustained narrative. So whose story is it when there isn't a person guiding you through it? I should say a character guiding you through it.
It's the story of the group.
Okay.
Or it's the situation story.
Yeah. So it's the story of the dilemma.
Or a tragedy, I would say.
A tragedy?
Yeah. I really keyed in on the Planned Parenthood. Mm-hmm. It just was like so nice to hear that there was access, and I was like, Planned Parenthood is amazing, and that's what I was holding on to, rather than the individual narrative, you know?
Right.
Maybe I was primed for that.
But. Yeah, when we originally worked on this piece, the Planned Parenthood wasn't in it. It was going to be more about the problems and not very much about solutions. And so I felt like so many pieces about trans people are like these just desperate, like no hope in the future kind of things. I mean, this is pretty like 20% of American trans people are HIV positive, which is huge. Here's a question that I wonder if you have thoughts on. What right do we have to hear this story? Is it voyeurism on our part?
Just to understand and to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
To be aware.
Yes?
If you're not aware of anyone who is, how do you get any facts? How do you get some sense of what kind of struggles they're going through, other than in this way?
I'll tell you the origin story of this piece. I was at a conference like a couple of years ago, probably 18 months before the piece aired, and it was a conference of the National Lesbian and Gay Journalists Association. I just went to a panel on, like, here are some things trans people would like you to know and they think you should cover. And the example of a trans woman needing a pap smear came up. And everybody on the panel had a story similar to that. Like, there were 6 people on this panel, and 2 trans men and 4 trans women, and they all said, there's no insurance code for somebody who's listed as male to have a pap smear. And that's a huge problem, because there are, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars if you can't code it properly. Yes?
Well, so I work in this population. I'm a family nurse practitioner, and I actually do transgendered health. And our electronic health records are getting so much better at that,
right,
so that you can code it correctly.
Right. So you hear in this piece, Planned Parenthood has worked with their electronic records people to be able to, but a lot of places still don't, and that's...
The issue more with that, though, is not the electronic health record from a perspective of billing. it's actually an issue with calling people the wrong names, right? Because I need to have your preferred name, not just your legal name, because your legal name is what's my medical record number. My biological sex is my sex that's listed, but that's not my sex.
Right.
And so since that's not my sex, I get called she, even though I am he,
right?
You know, as far as that goes. So that it creates a very hostile environment for these people.
We hear the guy who said he went out to his car after his first visit to Planned Parenthood, and it was the first time he'd ever been treated well at a doctor. I think he was in his 30s.
What you asked about, should we hear this story? Mm-hmm. What worries me about this story is someone listening to that and saying, this is yet another reason for us to defund Planned Parenthood.
Mm.
That it actually exposes Planned Parenthood to another
criticism.
Right.
And it's not we're listening to it and thinking it's wonderful, but how many people listen to it and think it's horrible?
Right, but how many people who didn't know where to go to get their health care, suddenly a trans person hearing it, or how many people heard this and said, I'm going to give $20 a month rather than $10 a month to Planned Parenthood. So, when I'm thinking of pieces, I'm not thinking of people's worst possible responses to them. I do have an editor above me who likes to think of people's worst possible. But you know, he's not from public radio, and I think I know our listeners better than he does. And he doesn't work for us anymore as of Monday.
I was in the doctors about a month or so ago, and they were shifting to actually asking me basically an inventory of my organs, and part of the justification was a shift from these biological and gender labels, and then the assumptions of the organs that are associated with those labels. But it was one of these things where she had to kind of explain to me
why she was doing this,
and if I had listened to this piece the week before. I think that I could imagine somebody in my shoes having some animosity or frustration at that. Like, oh, I'm just a dude, like, why can't you just say that I'm a dude and know that I have the dude parts? but you know, a little bit of broader context before coming into that scenario could ease those types of barriers more broadly.
Right, so, and I think it also helps us, this is maybe a hard thing to reach for, but I have this notion that, like, if you hear this story and you're cisgender, you might actually, like, bring it up with your doctor and say, hey, you know, I heard this story. How do you handle that?
Yeah.
I think that sort of allied action sounds like a weird World War II thing, but that could change people's minds, change doctors' sensitivities, change nurses' sensitivities as well. So, you know, I think a lot about the audience for stories as well. I want to play another piece from the transgender section, or from the LGBT section of the discrimination series. It's pretty short, it's under 4 minutes. So, at no point have I ever said to a reporter, please go out and do a piece about intersectionality, because that would create a terrible piece. This reporter, who's very, very experienced. We had a long conversation about discussing LGBT issues. This piece is specifically about trans people, a trans man and a trans woman. And I wanted to talk about race and ethnicity. And I wanted to talk about age differences. But I didn't want to hit people over the head with, like, you are hearing a piece about intersectionality. Because, you know, high-tech queer theory isn't something that you want sort of feed into you on Morning Edition. So, take a listen to this piece, and we'll discuss it.
LGBT Americans say discrimination is a problem, but there is disagreement over the cause. This comes from a poll conducted by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Respondents to this survey over the age of 50 tended to blame discrimination on individual prejudice, while younger generations pointed to both individuals and biased laws. The two people we're going to meet now reflect those viewpoints. Martha Biebinger of member station WBUR introduces us.
In a small colonial house in Springfield, Massachusetts, Idanu Rivera and Louis Mitchell do-si-do around the kitchen.
I offer coffee first.
I was thinking wine is in coffee, too.
Coffee is the lifeblood of my very existence.
Mitchell, a 57-year-old transgender man, owns this home. Rivera, a 27-year-old trans woman, rents a room. Many days, to avoid scoffs, stares, and physical threats, Rivera never leaves the house.
Once I step out there, it's war sometimes with people.
To avoid war, Rivera works from home as a marketing writer. When she does go out, Rivera does not try to convince anyone in the grocery store checkout line or her Puerto Rican family that it's okay for her to wear a skirt. She lives with the pain of trading contact with her family for the joy of being herself.
I can't change people who are so deeply rooted in their values, so the only thing I can do is to focus on policy and legislation, because we're always going to have a bias, but we need policy in place to reflect our values now in 2017.
Values that are becoming transgender friendly, Rivera says, at least among her generation.
Government needs to catch up.
Yeah.
Mitchell leans in. This United Church of Christ minister has been nodding often, but wants to make sure Rivera understands why older trans men and women are more focused on individual prejudice.
We've actually been around to see some policy changes.
Mitchell, who's African-American, mentions the Civil Rights Act.
And we've also seen where the policy changes have not necessarily made all of us safer.
Is there a story about
it's probably no shortage of stories. Well, in the first 6 months of my transition.
From presenting as a black woman to a black man.
I was probably pulled over 300% more in my first 6 months of transition than I had been in the previous 23 years of driving.
Mitchell still plans driving routes carefully because he says civil rights laws do not protect him from officers who see black men as a threat. Mitchell says laws are vital, but not enough yet.
In the meantime, I want to work on every heart that I can find to say, hey, it's me. You loved me yesterday. Why are you not loving me now?
So for people who are over 50, the battleground was the personal battleground.
Ray Carey, who runs the National LGBTQ Task Force, says older adults have lived for decades without legal protections, fighting those daily personal battles.
Who are my friends and neighbors and family, and are they going to support me when I come out?
But Carey says coming of age in the last decade or two as LGBT is completely different.
Their experience has been framed by working to get legal protections.
There's one more reason Adonri Rivera says many transgender 20 or 30-somethings focus on government. They rely on it for health insurance, employment assistance, and student loans.
So our dependence on the government is making us much more in tune as to the laws and policies in place that have put us there.
Well, beware, says Lewis Mitchell.
More dependence on the government and a less dependable government.
Mitchell and Rivera do agree that after years of progress, they are now fighting to hold on to legal and lived rights they thought were secure. For NPR News, I'm Martha Diebinger in Boston.
So this piece is very different from the first piece you listened to this afternoon, in that it's almost entirely two real people, mostly in conversation with themselves, with each other, more than in conversation with the reporter. How does that change how you hear the story? Think of it, compare it to the first piece we listened to, which is sort of the report.
It makes it their story.
Right. Right. It makes it their story. Does that help you understand? To hear them telling their experiences? Or would it be better to have a heavier narrator hand in the story?
I was just
that isn't an answer to that. I'm just asking.
You asked the question about does it feel voyeuristic for the last piece, and mm-hmm. this one I felt like because of this element of them having coffee, and I felt like I was, you know, should I be in the kitchen listening to them have this coffee conversation, and I was really eavesdropping on a more personal conversation, and so that felt a little more like I was listening in. Both of them, I think, raise awareness and shine a light on prevent invisibility, I think, in important sorts of ways. Where the other one just felt more like information download. Or this, I was like listening in a conversation and was more, I don't know, self-conscious about my listening in.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because my concern was the exact opposite because of the subject matter of the first one. Like, we're talking about body parts in the mm-hmm. first one. Yeah. And that, to me, seems way more intimate mm-hmm. in a really unearned way mm-hmm. than in what the second piece is about, are public interactions, whether they're personal public interactions with others, or, you know, at the line at the grocery store, as you say in the piece, or with your family, or with government. So that was my thinking about the difference, but I haven't thought of that. But you're right, it can seem much more intimate because it's them telling their stories. Yes.
I certainly feel like both are necessary because, you know, we're all different, right? So some people connect more to that intimate story, whereas many of us, you know, it's that factual piece. My problem is honestly the facts, like, they hurt me because, like, they talked about the surgical aspect, but not that is a small portion of the people that actually are trans want to have surgery.
Right.
And so it essentially says, if you're trans and you don't have surgery, well, you're not really trans.
Right.
And that's a big problem in the trans community.
Right. We are working on a piece right now at Portland on that very topic. Some insurance companies won't pay for surgery unless you go through hormone treatment. Some won't pay for that unless you go through counseling for a lengthy period of time first. But that is that is one way to do it. So we're working on that now. Stay tuned.
I thought that one of the things that was so interesting was that it went beyond the trans issue when he was talking about the racial profile of women, and that all of a sudden he's being pulled over and he's still the same person, but it was just an awareness that this is the plight of people of color, men of color.
So when Martha was done with that interview in Springfield, she called me on the drive home and she was like, I have gold. Because I have a person who was a black woman and is now a black man and can talk about the differences in his experience. Mm-hmm. And very few people can talk about the differences in those experiences. So, this piece could have... So in a stealth way, I could have brought this piece in through the African American discrimination section of our series. And, you know, maybe we could sort of rework it. If you reframe it in the intro, it's a piece about race and ethnicity. Maybe you'd have to focus a little bit more on the trans woman being Latino. But I think you could do it. You could reframe the story that's about race and ethnicity.
We're all connected, and these problems are not just in this narrow section. It affects...
Right, which is why I wanted to do a story that could invite you into it, mm-hmm. and that you would care about the multiple voices in this story, but I didn't hit the word intersectional was never used in the story.
So Jason, you just said something really interesting there. It was about how the storyteller frames the story.
Right.
The narrative doesn't actually change. Like the story of the black woman becoming a black man getting pulled over and whatever, that little bit of narrative doesn't change, but as the storyteller, if you frame it in a different way, the audience hears a different story,
right?
And so you're changing or distorting the story mm-hmm. to match the story you want to tell, rather than the story that the person shared. Or does that make sense? I mean, that sounded a little bit more modern.
Yeah, distorting isn't quite the word I would use.
Accentuating, but you change the listener experience,
right?
But the narrative of the character hasn't changed, but the storyteller changed.
Well, you know, we went into the interview talking about, like, we were specifically talking about LGBT issues, and so that's what came up. It happened that in the course of that interview, race came up, and that's what I think, you know, Martha did this brilliant move where it doesn't tell you it's going to be a story about race, and there it is in a really interesting way. And I actually wonder if it brought people into the story. Like, I'm listening to the story because it's a story about LGBT people, and then suddenly, oh, you have this, I hate the phrase aha moment because it's too overplayed, but, like, you know, this you have this moment of epiphany. Like, oh, I now understand something in a whole new way. Yeah,
Well, it's interesting with circuits closed, they're more complex. You know, suddenly the circuitry was still the same electrons traveling through the story, mm-hmm. but it closed another circuit.
Yeah.
It was a great experience, actually. Mm-hmm.
I think this might be my favorite piece in the LGBT section of the series because it's so complex and it tells you it's about one thing and then it becomes about this other thing.
Remember the voicing about policy? Mm-hmm.
And so it means suddenly you're running into a big, sort of a fallout of policy. So it makes that relevant.
I think when you have age and race added on to sexual identity, it makes the person more fully human.
Right.
Because we're all more than one thing. And so they're not representing all transgender people.
Right.
They have their individual story.
And they have, and what you're hearing is multiple voices telling their individual stories, and what's beginning to emerge for you as a listener is a picture of the whole. It's almost like each of those examples, each of those real people, is like a point in a pointillist piece where, like, as you back up, you start to see the big issue. So, I think the difference between, many differences between audio and print journalism, and print journalism, especially now that there are very few people actually read physical papers, there isn't much of a hard end to, like, this piece could be 1,200 words, it could be 1,500 words, it could be 2,000 words. At least in radio right now, everything has to be a certain kind of length, in part because of the way we use the radio, in part because certain kinds of information are best told orally, and other kinds of information are best told in writing, others are best told in both photography or graphics and such. And the thoughts about this story?
My hat's off to NPR. I cannot imagine my NBC, ABC, CBS ever touching this stuff. Mm. And for young people that are coming of age and trying to figure out the meaning of life and everything, to have this kind of stuff out there, so they say, oh, there's something else out there, or now I understand, or maybe I need to talk to someone about this.
You know, that's actually an issue that comes up time and again, in especially the areas that I cover. Remember, I said I edited LGBT issues, that's 4.5% of the US population. Native American issues, that's about 2% of the US population. Islam, about 1% of the US population. These are small groups. I'm not going to play this piece for you, but as part of the Muslim series that I worked on earlier this year, we had a piece about LGBT Muslims. Well, if Muslims are only 1% of the population, imagine how small the population of LGBT Muslims. And I'm in this constant, tense conversation with people above me about, like, why are we spending so much time on banishing these small populations? I think that's why we work in public radio, at least it's why I work in public media, and not, about 10% of the US population listens to us. I'm gonna guess that everybody in this room, or at least most of the people in this room, listen, but recognize what a small group that really is.
The listener base? The listener base?
10% of the US population listens to public radio, to public media.
70%
more. It might be slightly higher from state to state, but so, we want to cover. So this is an argument in religion coverage as well, like, do we spend too much time with evangelicals? Well, they are a quarter of the population. Do we spend enough time with Catholics, who are also a quarter of the population? No. We spend fairly little time with mainline Protestants, but I think with good reason, because there are so few. But we sometimes, especially reporters, think like, we told all the stories of mainline Protestants. We told them in the 90s, and it was all writing about gay clergy. And I hope that at least what I bring to this coverage is that we do hear from people who aren't fighting about that anymore, who have something to say. Any other questions?
As I've sat here, part of what I am reflecting on is that I think while the first story had an impact in terms of what felt tragic, feels tragic to me, the second one, with the more kind of personal, first-person conversation, I'm going to say it in some way makes me more humane.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have the opportunity in a small way to stand beside folks and get a little insight into what that is like to live that life. And so I don't know if that's an NPR goal.
Oh, it's my goal. Absolutely yeah. My goal. I say to all of my reporters from the time of the assignment, or if they pitch me the story versus me assigning it, who are we going to empathize with in this story? Mm-hmm. And I really want to have somebody.
Yeah.
And my concern about that first story at Play Key was that I'm not sure that there is mm-hmm. a really strong person to empathize with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of, so this is in the world of journalism, like we've been infested by all of these print people at NPR recently.
Yeah.
And I'm working very hard to get rid of them, but just this is being recorded. I'm fired when I get back. I'm going to come here for a year.
There are worse things.
Especially in this news environment. Where was I going? It's crucial to have people to empathize with in the story, not just so that you'll pay attention to the information I'm trying to convey to you, because there's actually a fair amount of information in that second story, but I want people to become more human in listening to these pieces, and I want them to understand people who are unlike themselves. But I also want them to understand their role in making the people in the stories feel either ostracized or accepted. So I want people to feel mm-hmm. not just empathy, but perhaps complicit mm-hmm. in some of these stories. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Well, listening to your sessions, it's been, I was an English major, so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, who's telling the story and the power of the editor and all those things are very interesting. But then it just absolutely, and who do we empathize with? But then it scares me to death when I think that there probably are as bright, talented people at Fox News yeah. doing the same thing.
You know, I used to make this joke. I had way more sex ed in public school than I ever had media education in public school. Mm-hmm. And people spend a lot more time in the media. So I think that you might consider doing better media education. I hope people spend a lot more time. This idea that the story that the person thinks they're telling you is one thing, but the story that the reporter decides to tell is not quite that story, or adjacent to the story, or not identical with that story.
And then you throw the editor in there.
Right. And we make everything better.
Or different at least.
Well, I mean, so all of these stories are actually shaped products. Like there is, I actually don't believe there is a story that exists apart from telling it. So you've got the main character of a story, or the two main characters in that second story, telling their stories, and so by telling the stories, those stories exist. Or at least they exist on the radio. You can't have a story on the radio without somebody telling it. So that you've got those stories from those two people being told, and then you also have the reporter in there telling the story, and you have me looking at this larger series, and how does this fit into our, you know, try to step back and look, like, in the course of the year, how many stories have we done about X, Y, or Z? And so I have, you know, very particular goals with each story, but I have broader goals with kinds of stories, and, you know, that might be a great fact. If we just don't have room for it in this story, or we don't have a great illustration of it in this story, so we're going to leave that for another story.
So my question
kind of going back to the topic of what right do we have to hear their stories, what right do you have to tell the stories, is what is your check on making sure that the story that you end up airing is close enough to the story of the character that they're not just a prop for the delivery of a message that you want to deliver?
So in part, it's because of how I like to help reporters approach the character in the story, and I always call them characters in stories. They're real people. I don't mean character as in like a character in a novel. I mean like they're a real person. And I hear this as about to say a few minutes ago, like all these print people who come in and they'll say things to me like, we need an anecdote. Well, who wants to be an anecdote? Like, I don't want to be an anecdote in somebody else's story. I want to be the subject of a story. Or I at least want to have some kind of subjectivity in a story. Not just a, oh yeah, let's stick this person here. I worried about that first piece, the way it opens with Ruby Barbie doll at the top of the piece. She was mostly there to get us inside. Like, there's a trans woman hanging outside the street here. Like, it was just an interesting like moment to get inside one more, and then I want to play because I've got two more to tell.
I'm just curious in terms of the theme of your lectures. Mm-hmm. Is there a story that you could briefly share with us where you decided no,
not to tell it?
Yeah.
Well, you can talk.
Well, I won't use names here. I will try to describe what I did.
And what criteria?
So. In the early aughts, through mid-aughts, I did a ton of coverage about clergy sex abuse. And there was a point at which a couple of times a week, clergy sex abuse survivors were calling me cold at WBEZ in Chicago to just say, this happened to me. Mm-hmm. And several of them said to me, and you're the first person I'm telling. And I thought, oh, well, that's not a good idea. And so I started keeping, like, you know, pinned to the bulletin board next to my desk because I'm a bit analog. Like the name of, or the contact information for SNAP, the Survivors Network of Lesbian and White Priests, the office within the prosecutor, Cook County Prosecutor's Office that dealt with those things or could help decide whether it was a prosecution that still could be brought. And I would also, for due diligence, give people the name and number of the victim's advocate within the archdiocese, but I would always remind them that that person did not work for them, they worked for the archdiocese. It's like HR does not work for you, HR works for the company to keep them from being sued. So there were a number of times when I would say to people, you know, thank you for telling me your story. I was trying to not be too harsh, like, I don't want to listen. And I would listen on the phone, but I would, you know, say, I might not be the right first person to tell the story to. So that's an example of me doing that. I did that a couple of times. When they said, you're the first person I'm telling, I just thought that was, I suppose some people would have been thrilled to say, like, I mean, never before told story, but it was also a bit into clergy sex abuse stories, and so we heard, and all the stories were so outrageously similar that I didn't need another example unless it was, say, a current case. These were cases from like 25 or 40 years ago that they were now talking about. What I ended up following through on more were the current cases because, you know, in the early aughts, as all of this reporting was going on, there were many in the Archdiocese of Chicago priests abusing kids at the time. And so I followed those a little more closely. Okay. So I want to play a piece from a series that I worked on earlier this year. Our correspondent, Little Fado, returned to the United States a little over a year ago. She had been covering the Arab Spring based in Cairo for basically from right before the Arab Spring started for the Washington Post, and then during the Arab Spring, then for about a year with the Post, and then came to us right after that, and so covered that transition. Our Cairo correspondent sort of has responsibility from Egypt all across the top of North Africa. So she travels around there. But she came back to the United States and proposed this series on Islam in America that aired in April. For those of you who subscribe to National Geographic, she also wrote a lengthy piece about Islam in America, basically a new generation of Muslim, the next generation of Muslim leadership is how we thought of it internally. I don't know that we ever used that phrase on the radio. But I want to play this piece for you that aired on Week of All Things Considered in April. It's the final piece of a six-part series. Each piece in a series is designed to be heard as a standalone piece, because the way that we listen to the radio is not the way we say. If you find the third, if you happen to run across the third piece in a five-part print series, you can online find the other parts. But if you're listening, it's pretty complicated to go back and you can't tell people, well, you should have heard 4 days ago this piece, and this piece will only make sense if you heard that piece. So you are not at a disadvantage for hearing the final piece. But I wanted to have the last two pieces give us a little hope. So let's listen to this one.
And now a story about the struggle of American Muslims against discrimination. NPR's Leila Fadel concludes her series on a new generation of American Muslims with this report on a family in Northern California.
Sana Afzal is 16. She's talking to her mom. She wears a pink scarf to cover her hair, leggings, and a sweater. In the fall of 2016, she started high school in the town of Gilroy outside San Jose.
You could tell that there was just kind of like this feeling of like, don't really go near her.
A new school is always hard. But doing it as a Muslim kid of color wearing a religious head covering is even harder.
And like, it's kind of just weird because they just kind of see you as the outsider and they leave you like that.
After the presidential election, the bullying started. First the note pinned to her backpack, "I like Trump, you're fired." Then a Fox News editorial assigned in her English honors class that linked a horrific stoning of a young couple in Afghanistan to Islam as a religion. The article was accompanied by a picture of a young woman in a headscarf.
One guy was like, "Do you know what this word means?" Because I guess he like saw the picture and saw me and was like, "It's the same thing."
Sana's classmate was linking her to this awful thing that happened in a country she'd never been to and knew little about. It made her feel
bad, I mean horrible.
And telling the story months later, she starts to cry. Her mom, Nishava, jumps in.
It was tough. You know, in our days, it was you get slapped with kick me signs. But it wasn't a safety issue. And I see her crying. I get worked up. So you're going to have to take them, you know, my kids and I were here. So we do what we can to protect them.
So Nishava helped her daughter figure out how to respond to the bullies. They chose education. The Afzal family contacted the school and two advocacy organizations, including the Islamic Network Group, or ING. Ishaq Pathan, the youth coordinator, says bullying like this is almost the norm for Muslim kids.
We deal with situations where they're being targeted or called terrorists. In some situations, this actually comes from the administrators or the teachers.
One study says more than 2 of 5 Muslim kids report bullying at school, and another says in California, it's more than half. So ING worked with the school and created a program to teach inclusion and understanding people's differences, including Muslims. Now it's a model ING pulls out for other schools who ask for help.
The main thing that we're focusing on is religious-based bullying, and a lot of what we believe is that religious-based bullying is based on ignorance and miseducation.
This year, the schools pulled the offending article from the English class, and Sana says things are better. Her battle is mostly over, but her family's and her community's is not. The family of six prays in a remodeled barn in nearby San Martin with the South Valley Islamic community. They've been trying to build a mosque for years, but the project's been a lightning rod. Nishava remembers the first land use meeting at the Santa Clara Planning Commission.
Person after person after that got up and just blasted, you know, "We don't want them here. They're breaking Sharia law. You guys are terrorists."
This kind of rhetoric interspersed with concerns about the building's environmental impact. Since then, it's been 6 years of legal back and forth. Nishava says you have to make a choice at moments like these. Accept it.
Or we say, no, this is not the America we want it to be. And we know American can be what we want, where it's inclusion and it's our rights. And we just want to practice.
And if all that isn't enough for one family, Nishava's eldest daughter, Maimona Afzal Berta, is getting bullied by her students. She also wears the scarf. The 23-year-old special education teacher in San Jose says the problems also started in the fall of 2016.
I'd hear someone shout from outside my classroom, you know, you're working with ISIS or you're a terrorist.
Others would say shoot her in motion like they were firing a machine gun. She talked to the administrators and Maimona helped them put together a program to teach kids about inclusion and celebrating diversity.
So at the end of that school year, it was like, wow, like we made some progress.
And so this past fall, she was excited to start teaching again. She showed up early on September 11th to get everything ready for a new unit on suspense. She turned the corner to her classroom.
And I find the windows and doors vandalized with words associating with terrorism. You know, ISIS, and just like very hateful words, profanities. And I was just like shocked.
Maimona went to the school again. She says one person asked if she wanted to change schools.
Your solution is essentially to get rid of me? I'm not the issue here. It's not even these students. It's the fact that we haven't done a good enough job of educating our students.
Anya Lozan, the principal at the middle school where Maimona teaches, says Maimona turned her trauma into teachable moments for the kids.
She has such great courage to speak up against the injustice that she had experienced specifically here at our school. And school is, you know, school is supposed to be a safe place for everybody, right?
Maimona says if this was happening in her school, a place with a majority student body of color, and it was happening other places too. So when a seat on her neighborhood school board opened up, she applied.
I am the granddaughter of a refugee and an orphan who fulfilled his dreams in this country through an educational experience.
She was up against five other candidates, and Maimona was chosen.
I, Maimona Hustle-Burda, do solemnly swear
that I will support and defend the Constitution.
That I will support and defend the Constitution.
I'm just honestly in shock. I mean, I've never seen a board member who looks like me, so it seems like a dream right now.
Maimona Afzal-Berta did this, she says, not only to change things for herself, but for her younger sister, for other Muslim families, and for any child who feels like an outsider. Layla Faldin, NPR News.
If you're interested in hearing more of those stories, you can just look up Muslims in America or Muslim Next Generation. And you can find all of the pieces together on the NPR website. So here's a question. Why is this story worth reinvading the lives of the women in the story? And the point where we enter the story, which we don't tell you at the beginning, like things have kind of worked out for them.
Okay. Can I just say? This is the first story where I actually think of the subject as the storyteller. Because the purpose of the story, which is education, your part, is actually her purpose. So there's an alignment of purpose here. And I didn't, all the other stuff you did, I felt like it was your story.
Yeah.
You used them, and I understand they willingly participated, but use them and edited them to tell your story. Right. But this is one where I feel like there was alignment, so therefore it was her story.
I would say that we did a better job of not showing you the scenes then, because this could have gone a bunch of different ways.
Yes, that's true. So,
I'm really nervous about the idea that like these people's stories is why I tell these stories. Their stories, you know, being just their stories, that's memoir. That's not journalism. And what I do is journalism. So the job of a journalist is to put many voices, including the voice of the reporter who has done a lot of work in the subject, and the editor, all in concert with each other to tell the story. So, I think that sometimes, in part, it can be a little confusing because if you listen to enough public radio, you hear things that sound like memoir, but they're super edited. Like if you listen to StoryCorps on Friday mornings, you know, those are like hour-long interviews that are cut down to 3 minutes. Mm-hmm. So they may have gone in, you know, 20 different directions in the course of that hour, and we found like the gold in it, but there may have been a lot of, you know, rubble in that interview as well. Or what we considered rubble for a national audience, but was probably what may be important for them to get down. But we were trying to think about, you know, we're thinking about many other things than just the people who tell the story. Other thoughts about this piece? Yeah?
When you do a piece, when it's done, do the people who are speaking get to approve or disapprove of it, or do
No, absolutely not.
Right.
So we will, in the course of working on a piece, if I have any concern that we are not saying clearly what I believe, because I don't just listen to the tape that you're hearing here, I listen to the whole interview, and the reporter listens to the whole interview, creates transcripts of the interview. And then after we edit the piece down, I go back to the original interview to make sure that we've couched it in terms of context. If there's any confusion, then I would call, or the reporter would call. This is sort of a journalistic distance sort of thing. The editor doesn't interact with the subject of the story. I interact with the reporter. The reporter interacts with the subject of the story. If there's any question or concern about the clarity, we would call the person and read back the tape. Like, we're using this quote, we want to make sure that we set it up properly. Especially with, you know, private individuals versus public officials or experts, even experts, anything outside of sort of elected officials or appointed officials, sometimes people misspeak totally accidentally. And if they tell you a story that, oh, you know what, I said that happened in the fall, but it really happened in the spring, we can edit around it and just, you know, have the reporter write in, you know, in the spring of whatever year. That's also sort of the fact-checking responsibility of the reporting after we're done writing the piece. With Layla, like, there were a few things where I was like, you say she works at the local university. What university is that? We wouldn't put it in the piece. I just wanted to know. And she looked up and she said, oh, it's actually a college, not a university. So say she works at the local college. So there's that sort of fact-checking too. The reason that I don't give final approval and that NPR does not give final approval to the subjects of stories is that it's our story, not their story, in our eyes. Part of their story is in it, but the whole is not under the control of any one person in the story except the editors and producers and reporters of a story. Maybe one more thing until, like, I'm gonna run over just a little bit. If you need to leave, that's fine, but I know this is lunch or dinner time. Any other thoughts on this one?
Well,
yes?
I would say this last story here, I remember in the spring when I heard it there that I was particularly influenced by the reporter, you know, talking about her own family here. I thought that was, I don't know, a really bigger impact to me to hear
right,
it like
so,
that.
So there's another piece in this series that I encourage you all to go and look up online, which was the piece that aired the morning of the day this piece aired. And Layla is telling us, the story is about an organization called the Mosque for All People, which is an LGBT inclusive mosque in Chicago. But after the piece airs, the host of the show, Lulu Garcia Navarro, well, actually, I have it here. That's not a plant, I didn't plant that question.
There are a little over.
I'm not going to play the whole piece. What I'm going to do is play for you the very end of the piece where she talks about, where Layla talks about why she wanted to do this story. Let's see if I can pull this off.
Hopes for is to make every mosque a mosque for all Muslims.
And now we're back with Layla Fadel. Layla, as I said at the top, you've been filing stories on Muslims in America all week long. But you used to cover Islam in the Middle East, where you were a foreign correspondent for so many years. And you are also an American Muslim yourself. What is behind this series? What inspired it?
Well, I think coming back, I went into it thinking, oh yeah, I know about Islam. I covered the Muslim majority world for years. But what I found was there is a uniqueness here that doesn't exist in the countries that I covered. You know, here, there are people from more than 75 countries practicing Islam with cultural references that come from those countries, but also come from this country. And so it was an incredible diversity that I'd never really seen anywhere else. And on top of all that, there was this ability to practice the way you want to practice. And so I met a surgeon in rural California who told me that America gave him the opportunity to practice being Muslim the way he wanted to, that he had literature on his shelves in his rustic farmhouse that would have gotten him put in jail in Malaysia. But here, he can read all of those things and be informed that way about the way he wants to practice and be faithful.
And what surprised you most out of your reporting?
Really, I think these young Muslims who are really unapologetic. They're really coming into themselves as American Muslims and saying, we belong here. We belong in a space here. And we're not going to let anybody tell us that we should go back to somewhere else. This is our country, and we're going to contribute to the tapestry of it as we have been for years.
And your reporting's not done?
It's not. We have another story to tell you about bullying in the Bay Area, and that will be on Weekend, All Things Considered.
And here's Liv.
So, yeah, there you have a little bit of insight. So that's actually a good place to...
Microphone. That's, I think, a nice... That could be an ending, but it could be a false ending, because there's this other piece I want to play for you, too. But it's nice to hear, like, Layla's interest in the story, and you wouldn't believe the conversations we had about whether she was going to say on the air that she's an American Muslim. It's not that hard to figure out, and it's not like it's a secret, but talking about her own experience of it, you know, you can tell she doesn't go into a great depth of detail about that. You know, she was actually raised in the Chicago, or the sort of Michigan to Chicago area, Loopish area around Michigan, Indiana, Chicago. But I think it does give you a little bit of insight into what she was thinking, less about her being Muslim and more about how, having lived in the Muslim world and seeing, like, in Egypt, this is the way that people had to do it because of all sorts of things there. In Libya, this was the way, and in Tunisia, this was the way. So you really, that was my favorite part of that little tale of the story. I want to play a final piece for you. This is a few years old at this point, but it is perhaps one of my favorite pieces that I've done in a long time. I think it plays, it gathers up what we've been talking about storytelling, the ethics of telling your story, telling other people's stories, and perhaps telling your own story or the story of us together. And I think it plays on some of the stuff that Diane has been talking about all this week in Bible study, with multiple voices telling stories that work in concert to tell a bigger story. So this aired on Weekend Edition Saturday about 4 or 5 years ago.
Last night marked the beginning of Passover, when Jews around the world tell the story of the Exodus. That tale, with its radical message of freedom, has resonated with African Americans since the days of slavery. As Gina Pritchett reports, over 40 years ago, these two communities wove their stories together for a new Passover ritual, the Freedom Seder.
On April 4, 1968, Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. The U.S. military rolled in to occupy Washington, D.C., and a week later, the sun set on the first night of Passover.
I walked home to get ready for the Seder, and that meant walking past the army with a machine gun pointed at the block I lived on. And my kishkas, my guts, began to say, this is Pharaoh's army.
Arthur Wasco is now a rabbi, but in 1968, he was working in the peace and civil rights movements. And he decided to come up with a new Haggadah, a guide to the Passover service that spoke to this moment.
I wove the story of the liberation of ancient Hebrews from Pharaoh with the liberation struggles of Black America, of the Vietnamese people, passages from Dr. King, from Gandhi.
In 1969, on the anniversary of King's death, 800 people gathered in the basement of Lincoln Temple, a Black church in Washington, D.C. There were Jews and Christians, rabbis and ministers, Black and white. And they use Wasco's Haggadah to hold a freedom seder. When you listen, it really sounds like a prayer for that moment, both mournful and, at the same time, electric.
It was the bush that burned and burned and did not stop burning. What was God all burned up about? It was the physical, economic, and spiritual suffering.
In the church basement that night, the spirit was high.
Topper Carew was one of the readers leading the service. He is now a filmmaker and television producer. But in the late 1960s, Carew was an urban designer working in the civil rights movement.
I will tell you that this was the first Seder that I'd ever been to. I didn't even know what a Seder was. But religion has been a northern star for, you know, much of the movement activity that is going on in the Black community.
And at Passover, according to Arthur Wasco, that northern star can light up the room.
There is a line that says, in every generation, every human being must look upon himself, herself, as if we go forth from slavery to freedom. And that night, that line became utterly real.
We were slaves unto Pharaoh in Egypt. The Lord our God brought us forth from thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm.
By the late 60s, it was clearer and clearer that American society had opened up to include the Jewish community. It had not opened up, it still hasn't really opened up to include the black community.
Black and white young rebels are free people, free in a way that Americans have never been before in the history of their country. All power to the people. All power to the people.
Topper Carew raised his fist in that rallying cry more than 45 years ago, but he still remembers the power of that moment.
Both the Jewish community and the black community have suffered great atrocities, and so the fact that we were coming together was a very important and powerful idea. And the way to best understand that was when people locked arms and saying, we shall overcome.
Moving from slavery to freedom is an eternal journey, a story communities write and rewrite, tell and retell, year after year. Because just as at the Freedom Seder in 1969, there is much to celebrate together, and much work left to do. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
So I think that's...
So I think that piece is kind of the culmination of what I've been trying to get at over the last three sessions, and hopefully within this session, that multiple stories being told in concert with each other tell a bigger story. And that one of the things I love about this particular piece is that it's telling an ancient story with a mid-century story, shall we say, that is still a current story here in the United States. So the line at the end there, you may not notice, reporters write big chunks of the story, editors write some parts of the story. I'm particularly proud of that. We tell and retell stories until they become true. I really like that line. I actually use it a lot these days. So thank you very much for coming to Under the Intimacy.